Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
We ended up getting the M2 Pro Mac Mini and the M2 Max 14-inch. But like the base level M2 Max that you can configure.
And for what purpose? Like what's it, how is it going to be used? Like what made you go pro instead of staying baseline?
So I just like that we're jumping right into it. So all right, welcome to the episode. We have... I don't want to offend any other guests, but we were just nerding out before we even Tyler was trying to figure out his camera setup, and he's got a new camera that he was working on, and I was just about ready to start the whole show and say, forget about the Max, let's talk about your camera setup. But I think everybody else would want to talk about the Max, so unfortunately we have to cater to the audience. But one day.
I mean, there's a lot of both. Yeah, well, hopefully, you know, sometime we'll have time to talk about cameras, because I spend a lot of time talking about them. I have a lot of thoughts, but... Macs are the big news right now.
A little foreshadowing. We will eventually get into some iPhone 15 camera stuff, but that'll be later on in this episode. But yeah, Tyler Stallman, thank you so much for joining us. I know it was short notice, but we are talking about the new Macs. And you just asked me, what purpose are we going to be using these Macs? So basically for us, it was for testing. But which one am I keeping? I use a Mac Studio. And honestly, I did my video on the M2 Pro Mac Mini, and I am fairly confident. My time was limited, so I would love to hear more from you about this. But I feel very confident that with the $1,299 M2 Pro Mac Mini, I could do everything that I needed to do to run the YouTube channel for Mac Rumors. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, and I bet you could actually get away with less, too. So the one that I've been my review unit has been the base model, which usually when I'm working with Apple, if they're going to send me something to review, I'm like, just give me the best of the best, because I'm talking to filmmakers and photographers and people that do production for a living, right? So they're really relying on their machines. But what I really found interesting about this Mac Mini is that at those lowest prices, it is really usable. Like, obviously, Apple's always tried to hit interesting entry price points, like, you know, $999 for a MacBook Air, for example, or you know, previous Mac Minis, whatever they were. But it always meant like, okay, that's the price they say, but you can't really spend that much because you've got to spec it up to actually have it usable. Otherwise, you're only browsing the web and writing Word documents. And now we're in this generation where those entry price points mean you can edit 4K video with multi-track and do... like produce a full podcast, do basic streaming, Photoshop and Lightroom are going to run fine. Everything works on these machines, and that's new and totally blows me away.
So one thing that I didn't get a chance to test yet, we'll stick with the Mac Mini for now. I had the base model M1 Mac Mini, and for a while we used that for, you know, for this podcast. The way this room is set up, there's a screen right here and everything's hooked up. And that's what I would use primarily just for the podcast. And I think it was a combination of Bluetooth issues, and it could be just from a performance standpoint. But when using Ecamm and having headphones, having the Rodecaster plugged in, I actually had to get rid of the Rodecaster for now. Once we move into a new setup, I'm going to hook it all back up and use a different computer for that. But I think it was just a combination of, I'm guessing it was the Bluetooth issues. It would eventually cut out. Like, I'd have to stop the recording. The recording would actually tell me that it failed and would just stop on its own. And so that's where it leads me to be performance issues. But I noticed that if I just took out the AirPods, it didn't do that. And so I wondered, Bluetooth, what is it, 5.3 now? Do you notice any of the common Bluetooth issues that people have ran into last year or 2 years ago?
I haven't run into a lot of serious Bluetooth issues. I think maybe because I don't lean that hard on it. Like AirPods are the main my keyboard stuff, but no, I'm using like the Logitech adapter as well. So I think I'm just not leaning hard enough on Bluetooth to maybe encounter any of this, and AirPods, I don't know how they're communicating. Like they have their own magic. So I haven't run into those specific issues. things, I mean, I definitely ran into some like real bugs on the M1 studio in Final Cut, for example, that were like, there was like, not just performance issues. Obviously the machine could handle it because the review unit I was using is the M1 Ultra, and it would start chugging in weird places and slow down in places that my M1 Max would not. So there clearly are these little pockets of bugs that would kind of rob you of what you were hoping for from that performance. So I encountered them in different places. But no, I nothing specifically with Bluetooth, but I wasn't using the M1 Mac Mini either. Just this is the first Mac Mini I've ever used, actually.
So for me, I suppose for a lot of us, the thing that's really interesting is this M2 Pro machine in particular, because it's offering performance from a Mac Mini that we just haven't really been able to get before. And this sort of, it puts the Mac Mini in an interesting place and an interesting price point compared to the Mac Studio, particularly the M1 Max version of that machine. And even in the future, when that maybe is an M2 Max, I suppose the question I have is, how do you think that is looking in the lineup now? How do you think that, who do you think that the M1 Max Mac Studio really makes sense for when you have this M2 Pro machine that really is offering really a very comparable level of performance, and you're only losing what, a couple of Thunderbolt ports, the SD card slot, but that's for $700 less. So what are your thoughts about that, Tyler?
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts are it's a very strange crossover, and I think we're in a place where anybody that is price sensitive, meaning, you know, a company isn't buying it for you, and you don't have to just, you know, there are definitely, especially in production environments, there's definitely situations where it's like, you know, just tell us the price and that's what it's going to be. But that's when you're working in, you know, you're not a solo operator. You're not doing things the way that all of us are. You know, most online creators don't have that luxury. And for people that are, you know, see $700 as a big chunk of their computer investment, that would be hard to justify. Instantly, as soon as just reviewing the Mac Mini, just doing my tests, I really missed those front USB ports as well as the SD card reader. It really kind of makes the desk a little messier. So it is significant for somebody doing photo and video production. But I mean, yeah, when you say $700, I didn't do the pricing myself, so I haven't seen when do you end up paying that studio premium yet. But performance wise, I don't think there's a lot of scenarios where you would choose the studio, you know, unless you're going all the way up to the Ultra.
Yeah, and I think that we're seeing this in the benchmarks as well, because with that M2 Pro machine, it is outperforming the M1 Max Mac Studio in single core and in multi-core. It's only really when you're leveraging the GPU that you're getting that better performance. So I think that creates a little bit of an interesting conundrum for people that are actually considering these machines at this time. And I suppose a lot of the question is how long Apple goes now before updating the Mac Studio. Because the natural time, really, I suppose, would have been now or around about now to prevent this overlap.
Well, and of course, it's going to get a lot more confusing once whatever happens with the Mac Pro. That, you know, they've said it's happening. Like they've said we're getting one. So otherwise, I think a lot of us would be like, oh, no, it's just the Mac Studio. That's what we're getting. That's what it's going to be. But you know, since it seems like they're working on it, it's hard to imagine. It's both hard to imagine what a Mac Pro would be right now, but even harder to see a Mac Mini, Mac Studio, and Mac Pro is a very crowded lineup potentially for somebody that's in that market. So I don't know. Yeah, it's really easy to recommend a Mac Mini right now, and it just got a little quite a bit harder to know who the Mac Studio is for, especially with an impending Mac Pro that we don't know what it's going to offer or how it's going to differentiate itself. But also, before we go like way into the episode, I'll also disclaim that like a lot of when I'm talking about Mac products and stuff, I avoid rumors a lot. So the fact that I'm talking to the Mac rumors guys is funny for me right now. But like, I kind of like going into keynotes with no spoilers. Obviously, I have a sense of like what's coming up and stuff, but I definitely don't follow every leak, and I'm much more interested in what was just released rather than what might be released in the future. So I'll be at somewhat of a disadvantage to you guys.
So you don't want me to tell you everything that's going to happen? Because it...
No, yeah, no. Keep it a surprise.
I was going to say, because I love this job and everything, but it ruins all events. Like, nothing is a surprise.
Yeah. Well, no, this event, this the spoiling of this little announcement was a great example of taking some of the joy out of it, I feel like. Because we found out one day ahead of time.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
such a small advance notice that I don't think that really changed anybody's buying schedule. It didn't allow people to make a different that's the argument for rumors, I think, is like you're gonna invest a lot of money, so knowing what's coming up is very helpful sometimes. But this wasn't what happened. We just found out hours before effectively, and so then the announcement came and it was like, oh well, saw that coming. It's like, well, but it's actually very surprising. Like this is a weird thing. So
see, I think the opposite, yeah, because I thought it was nice to like only have 24 hours of notice, because while we were pretty sure what right. was going to happen, it was like, but there could be something else we didn't know. And like, I think the HomePod was a little bit of a surprise too, even though like,
total surprise.
Yeah. Cause like, I think German, even right before it happened, was like, yeah, it's coming, but like, he didn't say it was coming tomorrow. And then it literally just the next day, it was like, oh yeah, here's the new HomePod. Now, whether or not that was exciting in terms of the product itself, different story, but,
right.
But yeah, anyways, back to the Mac Pro, or I'm sorry, this is the worst part about all these names.
Exactly.
I can't. I think I just gave up. And in one of, like, yesterday's video, I'm like, listen, I'm going to mess up and you're just going to have to deal with it. I'm talking about these two machines. And if I say anything else, just ignore me. Like, I don't know how to, like, keep it all in my brain. But okay, so the M2 Pro Mac Mini was what I have, but you have the base model M2 Mac Mini. Have you been able to test those timelines to see if they like, if that machine can handle your workflow outside of just a basic YouTube video?
So I have a bit of a, like a stress test timeline that I've been opening up on kind of every machine lately that it's not a real use case. It's mostly a mixture of footage that I know can stress out machines for various reasons, and then stacked layers of plugins, mostly motion VFX, because they write things well for Final Cut Pro, and then also Resolve. But so in Final Cut, what I found was that the 4K footage of any flavor was totally fine, like absolutely no slowdowns unless you start really kind of over processing it, and that's including basic transform LUTs and like a film emulation LUT. Just throwing two LUTs on there, corrections, nothing happens. And then I also tried some 6K HEVC footage. That was fine. But I did run into slowdown starting with 8K H.265 footage from the Canon R5 that would not play back smoothly in quality mode in Final Cut. And then as well, obviously, 8K RAW didn't play back. But what was interesting, what was great, is that the 6K Red RAW did play back without any hiccups at all. And Red RAW is much better optimized than Canon RAW Lite. Like, yeah. It depends which flavor of RAW you're working with. So obviously, I think ProRes RAW would also play back well. So that's good to know. I mean, 6K RAW works fine. I don't have any 8K RAW in that timeline. So, but I have a suspicion that would also work. So things coming from the Red Raptor would probably also, it feels like they'd play back. So as soon as you start stacking anything, if you're obviously doing any kind of noise removal, anything like that, can't handle it. It is too slow, but you can kind of work with any footage, and you may have to just like your finishing step, you may have to switch down to either performance playback, or then you would need a proxy workflow if you're really going to be intensive about it.
Have you noticed anything with the SSDs? It's not really a controversy anymore, but the base models do only have the one NAND chip there. So it does slow it down, but I mean, even with the other ones that I've used, I personally haven't noticed anything crazy during my day-to-day work, but have you had any issues with that, especially with working with those larger files?
Well, so that's the one step above base that I did get, and that's the 512.
They didn't give you the 256.
So I actually... And I don't know if they were paying attention to what I asked for, but when they said they were going to send me something, first it was like, send me the bottom of the barrel baseline.
Okay.
And then I thought a second later, I'm like, wait a minute, no, let's upgrade the drive, because that's I suspected this was going to happen again. And the thing is I would recommend this one upgrade,
sure,
kind of no matter what, but not even for the reason that most people talk about. So when this started being, like you say, like a controversy, I felt like it was overblown. And thinking about it more, I get why a lot of people talked about it, and it's important to know. But if you're really buying the absolute base Mac, your priorities are probably quite different from mine, and extreme performance may not be the first thing you're thinking about. And I actually think what slows you down more with the 256 gig internal drive is just managing the files. I mean, just my downloads folder will start to balloon past that. Like the apps on my computer will take up most of that space, and you'll be operating in a very narrow margin of free disk space all the time. And I just don't think that's healthy. So that's the biggest reason that I just don't think anybody should lean that heavily on their external drives. So that's the first reason to upgrade to 512. And then obviously, in addition to that, you're going to get the faster disk space. So I did have that one bump, which is $200 more, and I think everyone should.
So speaking of upgrades, at what point would you say it's worth upgrading the memory?
That is a good question. So, I mean, I've done quite a bit of editing full YouTube videos on the with just 8 gigs of RAM on the M1, and I did a couple client projects as well. It's one of those things where, like I said earlier, that what's amazing is that you can edit it, because before you just couldn't do it, right? Yeah. You couldn't even open the files. So it's now more a matter of like, how long are you willing to wait for certain things? Playback will be there for any sort of standard 4K workflow, any photography work at this point, which has become a challenge in my review videos, actually, is that I've always talked about it, like, from a photographer and filmmaker perspective, that's kind of my thing. The photography tests are getting really boring because there's not much you can't do anymore. Like the things that a photographer is going to run into are like, if you're tethering and like offloading a lot of 50 megapixel photos quickly, and how fast can it keep up? Like, can it keep up with the buffer? And it's like these kind of edge use cases, even on base models. So the photography world is just handled so well at this point. That's why I've been talking about video so much more, and also starting to test AI more, because I think we'll have some interesting use cases with on machine AI running, and it definitely stresses any of these machines out. So I think that's where all the most interesting new benchmarks are going to be.
So I think my problem is, like, whenever I try to recommend which one to get to people, like, my thing personally, I feel like you definitely need at least 512. I used to always tell people, like, I don't think you need to worry about that. The SSD is, just get external, you're fine. And then I have come into that issue where I'm just just random day-to-day files and nothing to do with video editing. I am running into I have low system memory and storage, and I'm just like, okay, this is annoying. I need to upgrade. So now I've just been baseline a terabyte. I don't go more than that, and I definitely don't go less. I feel like 512 is pushing it, but definitely get away from the 256 if you can. So when you start to do that, and then I just for me personally, I'm like, all right, let's go up to 16 gigs. I don't think you need much more than that. So when you price that out, it's what, $999, I believe. And then you kind of get into the ballooning thing.
That's still great.
It is great.
I forgot, but that's great.
That's 512 and 16 gigs, and that's still great.
Sure.
And then I start to think, well, if you just go to $1,299, you can get the M2 Pro. And that's where I draw the line. I draw it right there. But like, that's where people are always like, well, if you wait and wait and wait, or if you get a little bit, they're just trying to get you to keep going up and up. And I think the line is somewhere between that $999 and $1,299 for me personally. What do you think?
No, I think that's a really sweet spot. If you're price sensitive but hungry for performance, 16 gigs and 512. That's an appropriate balance. You're going to have to lean on external disks, obviously. And I think it's sort of weird how, there's a lot of discussion about these internal drive speeds. And it's like, it's really going to slow it down. And that really matters for your system files, right? So that's why you need a big enough disk, so you've got enough extra space so that, having a full SSD isn't slowing you down, and that you're not running out of, you're not constantly deleting things. But what happens if you have a smaller drive is also that you're constantly plugging in what are much slower USB drives all the time. Like, I don't think most people have a stack of large Thunderbolt SSDs kicking around. Personally, I'm editing even like the 8K and 6K stuff. I'm working from USB-C SSDs. I usually use the SanDisk ones, which are way slower than like any sort of internal or even Thunderbolt. And it isn't a bottleneck. That doesn't slow me down. They are still performant enough. So I think that extreme speed matters for your system files. All your applications should be installed on something that fast. You don't need to be accessing video or photo files that quickly, because that's just not usually the bottleneck.
Hartley, I need to know, because you have drastically different workflows than us. And I think people are, I don't know what our listeners are at in terms of like how they use their machines. I'm guessing not everyone is a video editor, a photographer, and they're probably not doing any kind of production. So they might be more in line with your idea. What do you think would be the sweet spot, and which machine would you pick?
No, I would agree with exactly what you've said, Dan, because I do think that 8 gigabytes of memory for an Apple Silicon machine for a lot of users isn't quite enough. I don't think you need to be a professional to be hitting a ceiling on 8 gigabytes of memory. And of course, macOS is so good at memory optimization that you don't really feel it a lot of the time, but that's going to be eating into your storage as well. If you have enough tabs open and you're not doing anything too crazy, but you're still going to be using memory swap at some point there. So I think that 512 and 16 gigabytes is a good benchmark. I mean, that's actually what I configured for my M1 Mac Mini, because I didn't have the option of an M2 Pro or an M1 Pro when that was first around, and I haven't had the most fantastic experience with that machine, but I do think the specs I chose were right for someone that is not dealing with video and is just effectively just really pushing it with browser tabs ultimately.
That's
what most people do.
Especially if you're on Chrome, we know the memes and the jokes, like having a bunch of Chrome tabs going to set your computer on fire. But I feel the same way with Safari too. I mean, how many times have I looked into like the top where your battery is, especially on a laptop, and it's like, this is eating a ton of memory and power, and it's just like, it's Safari all the time. So I mean, yeah, especially with you, you're balancing a bunch of different tabs open, and you're writing in an Obsidian. Do you write in Obsidian? I know we've been talking about that app.
But Obsidian's pretty light. It's when you're using WordPress and you have like 15 WordPress tabs open.
Yeah.
And then on top of your other like 100 tabs, that's when it does start to test things, when you've then also got 20 applications open.
Sure.
Even if it's not heavy, it's just that is going to be using the memory.
Yeah, you guys are right and kind of are reminding me of what there's the two angles of, like, you can kind of do the benchmarks in a bit of a silo sometimes, and it's like, look, Final Cut's doing great because nothing else is running. But the reality is, I've got 15 tabs open while I'm editing in Final Cut a lot of the time. And so it's, how disciplined are you about keeping the applications you're not working with closed in the background? That definitely ties into the, like, can you get by on less RAM? Is like, well, are you the type of person that leaves a lot of stuff open? Because if you are, you're going to need more. So.
And it's not like you're trying to mislead people, but like, Apple gives you the product and you have about 3 days. If our rumors were correct, you got it on Wednesday and you had Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Yeah, I think I got it later than that.
Okay. Yeah. So I know some people might've gotten it Wednesday or Thursday. And if you got it later than that, that's even worse. That basically means you had to test it on the weekend and you had to get it out by 9 a.m. Monday, this past Monday. And so, I mean, you don't have a lot of time to make that computer your own, get it to where you've loaded a bunch of crap on there from the downloads. And, it's not your laptop. It's not your Mac Mini. It's not the way you've had it. You've been using it for at least a couple of months. And so that's when you can get an idea. If they give you at least a few weeks to be able to test that, I feel like it's a better representation when you start to do those benchmarks than when it's like, this is a fresh computer. Of course, it's going to be super fast and on top of everything. But it's not your fault. This is just what we're working with. So it's kind of like, you take the benchmarks and everything with a grain of salt.
Yeah, and that the way that the algorithm machine works is that, like, releasing those later videos of, like, 6 months of working on the MacBook Pro or whatever, it's like they don't get the same views, right? But they're more accurate. They're kind of more informative and more interesting. It's really what people should be watching, but all the attention is there on day one, so you need to get the day one video out, even though you know it's going to be missing a lot of the context. I think a lot of people don't appreciate how much time reviewing each computer is just setting it up. I mean, a good example is like just to run my Final Cut tests, I need to install all of the plugins that that project is using and install all my LUTs. And yeah, just getting it to that point where it can open the same projects, that's like half the time.
Yeah. And when you're not working under an embargo, you have to beat everyone else that picked up the laptop that or the Mac Mini that wasn't able to get it ahead of time. And I mean, you're right. We're working with like I have to get it out that day. So yesterday I got a Mac Mini and I set it up. I ran benchmarks all in a day. And I, you know, I'm not complaining or bragging, but it's hard to do all of that. I didn't eat. I didn't take a break. There was no time. And so, yeah, I mean, like, there's a disclaimer with those videos. Like, those are just raw benchmarks, fresh out of the box. Take it for what you will. Some of it's going to be a little accurate, but, like, over time, that's going to degrade. And so you really should watch the videos that Tyler puts out over the next couple of months where he goes back and visits them, because that is going to be the most accurate representation.
Or moments like this, like when the new thing comes out, we start to revisit the last year's model. Yes. That's kind of when you hear all the dirt of like, oh yeah, there was bugs in Final Cut and, you know, Bluetooth had this issue because we didn't discover it until 6 months in or 8 months in. So, you know, it takes so long to get that context. And it's definitely, like you say, it's the grain of salt that you need to have when you're watching all early reviews, because there's no other way to factor it in. So
I agree. My other question is, at what point do we start overvaluing the Mac Mini because we realize that, like, you know, my brother the other day was like, hey, I think I want to get this new Mac Mini. And I'm like, okay, cool. Do you have a good monitor, keyboard, mouse that you want to use? And he's like, well, I was thinking about getting a new monitor with it. Like, I want like a fresh new setup. And I think a lot of people kind of want that. And then they start to look at the price. And then at what point am I just kind of like, well, what about just getting the M2 Pro MacBook Pro? Like, I just feel like you're already pushing yourself towards that price. And now you have a, let's be honest, you're probably not going to find a better display than the MacBook Pro, unless you're going studio display. And even then, you're still not getting the whole refresh rate and everything. So, I mean, at what point in your, both of you, this is a question for both of you, do you guys start to think, okay, well, we're bumping up the Mac Mini. Now I'm thinking the MacBook Pro might be better for this person.
I've had to think about this lately, because when I write a lot of the buyer's guides that we do on Mac Rumors, which means I have to sort of evaluate a lot of these positions that different customers take. For me, I think that if you're looking at that M2 Pro Mac Mini, and you're going to pair it with a brand new studio display, then I think that's good. I think that's a good deal, especially if you're the sort of customer that knows you need a desktop Mac, and you know that effectively you would have been a Mac Studio customer, and you're sort of dialing it back a little bit from that, and you're treating it as making a saving. But if you are looking at the baseline M2 model, and you're going to pair it with the studio display, which is what, about $1,700? I mean, that is an enormous amount more cash for that display. And then if you cheap out on the display too much, I would also question that as well. And I think that what you have to do is it's obviously different for everyone. So you have to spec it up, and you have to look at exactly what memory, what storage, and then you need to compare that with what you can get for a laptop, because something like the MacBook Air, especially that they still have the M1 MacBook Air, that's still a great machine. For under $1,000, and it's all in one. So if you're something like a student, you probably shouldn't be looking at the Mac Mini, because by the time you add a display to that, that is going to get very pricey, and it isn't portable. You've still got to buy your keyboard. It's just you're losing a lot of convenience, and that has to be bear in mind. But I would have thought for companies, for educational contexts, and if you are determined to have a desktop specific Mac, maybe you already have a display you like, maybe you're upgrading from a 2018 Mac Mini or something, then that's where
it's really a no brainer for those people.
Yeah. But if you're going to be buying it with a $1,700 display, you need to think carefully about how you're pricing that. I mean, I'd actually say, you know, that it's Mac Studio that shows it, that you can, the M1 Ultra Mac Studio is $399, I believe. And then if you add the studio,
$39.99. I wish it was $399.
Oh yeah. That's right. Then you're pushing near toward $5,000 which is an enormous amount of money. And you, it kind of creeps up on you. So yeah.
I think I just spent $5,000 today.
Well, I'm glad to see we do have a few more options coming after CES. Who announced them? I already forget. I just remember seeing that there's two new 6K options that we've really been lacking. So, you know, I think a lot of people, if they're going to pick up a Mac Mini to save money, will probably be pairing it with some mediocre 4K monitor that isn't going to perform great. I do have, there's one machine I kind of run in the background sometimes that is using a 4K, and I do sometimes forget that it's not looking correct. Like, it does look bad. When you stare at it close enough, the pixel issues are visible, but once you're working on it for a few hours, it can slip away. So if you really need to save money, you can with a cheaper display and then still have like a Mac experience. But it's obviously not ideal. And this also all does remind me that I still miss the 27-inch iMac. Even though we have all these substitutes now, I've worked at a bunch of creative jobs in like big offices with tons of designers and programmers, and all of those situations historically, the whole office was a 27-inch iMac. I mean, like that was the default of what you buy most people, unless you needed a laptop. But you could always get more power in the iMac, so that was kind of where most people started off. And obviously, we're in a different world now that's shifting, but it's still weird to me that is missing. And I don't know, there's so many products now in the Mac lineup that it's almost hard for me to argue like, oh no, we need to bring back one more. But it does still seem like a hole, even though we have this great Mac Mini, we have the Mac, we have all these things, and still missing that 27-inch iMac.
The iMac Pro was like one of the most perfect machines, in my opinion. I thought it was so good. I used it for everything. I had no like thoughts about even remotely upgrading to anything else. I'm like, nah, this is still really good. And I had the base model, like the cheapest one you could get, and it was perfect. But now I'm sitting here. I agree. I want a new iMac. I think that would be what I would, and that's what I actually push people towards even more now. Like when I was telling you about that, my brother, like I literally told him like, here's what you could get. And if this is what you're speccing it out, keep in mind, you're going to want a monitor. And if you want something that looks nice, why don't you just look at an iMac or a MacBook? And he specifically wanted a desktop. So I said, well, look at the 24-inch iMac. Like that's probably good enough for what you want to do. I don't know. We all live in this bubble too. So it's really hard. I know there's plenty of people out there like, I've got an old monitor from 15 years ago. It's fine. And then that's perfect. Then you can get whatever works for you. But if you're getting this specifically for what we are thinking about, which would be content creation, because that's what we do, you don't want to skimp out on the monitor, because that is also important for the quality of the work that you're doing. So
if I put myself in my college days, like mindset of like, you know, every dollar I need to stretch. I mean, I really can see a situation though where it's like, you know, there's some pretty half decent, like $600 4K monitors that like, they're going to show you basically what's happening. Your color grades may not be completely accurate. Obviously, you're not going to have HDR, but most people don't master for HDR anyway. You know, a cheap, totally mediocre 4K monitor can actually do 90% of what needs to be done. It just won't be as pleasurable of an experience. So yeah. For people really looking to save, I do think it's still an option. I'm going to grab water while you guys...
yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I just think the overall like theory or theme of all of these new Macs is that there's something there for you and it's going to be just fine. You just need to figure out what it is that you need in terms of, you know, what's the most important to you. If you work with a lot of cloud files, then you probably don't need to upgrade your storage. I still would advocate for 512 no matter what you're doing. But yeah, I mean, you can just kind of pick and choose. There's so many options in a world where I never thought we would say that, because Apple doesn't usually give a lot of options for things. But now it's just like over the last however many years, there's so many options that you're bound to find something that could fit your workflow.
And of course,
do you guys find it harder or easier to recommend a machine right now? I feel like it's yeah, because there's so many.
Significantly harder.
I feel like it's a little easier because at least all the options are good now. Sure. Whereas if I think back to like maybe 5 years ago, it was like, I don't know, like, you know, if you happen to need an iMac Pro, there's a great answer for you out there. But, you know, when you're looking at the MacBook Pros, like, I don't know, all of them are a little bit compromised. You're paying a bit too much for this and that. So at least now there's kind of no bad options. Like, whatever you get, it's going to do most of what you need. But it's definitely more complicated.
I think that we'll be in a stronger position at the end of this year, because these anomalies that we're seeing with things like the Mac Studio, and to a lesser extent, or maybe even a greater extent, the iMac being left with the M1 chip, these things will have been evened out by the end of the year, and we should see a lineup that scales with price and performance in a bit more of a logical way. Because I would struggle with some of the Macs, like the M1 iMac and like the M1 Max Mac Studio, to recommend those right now. And at the end of the year, we may well be looking at a new iMac Pro, as well as an M3 iMac, and even a brand new 15-inch MacBook Air. So we're going to be sort of reorienting to, you know, the lineup isn't done yet. The lineup is very much still in progress. And I think that it's just slowly starting to fall into place.
You guys have followed Apple for a long time. Do you feel like there's ever a time where the whole lineup in one moment is like, this snapshot of what's available all makes sense? Like, each category, like, this fits where it should, and everything is segmented properly? Because I always feel like we're always always like waiting for it to, like, oh, everything's going to slot into place. The upgrade cycle is running smoothly. And maybe it happens in narrower categories. Sometimes the iPhone is like, oh, all the iPhones available right now, I know how they fit. But that typically, there's always this weird overlap between generations.
Yeah, I would agree.
I'm trying to think of something right now where it fits, and I honestly, like, I could make an argument for each one being like, well, I don't know if I would get that.
It's the Mac that's the issue, because if you're looking at a smaller,
the iPads too.
iPads are kind of messy.
Yeah. The iPad now, but if you were to go back a couple of years to the iPad, when you just had maybe the iPad Air, the iPad Mini, and the iPad Pro, that kind of, and obviously the entry level, that sort of makes sense. And, you know, I think we can see it with other product lineups, but the Mac, there's so many of them, and there's just and the way that you can customize the configurations, and the way that people are so particular about external displays and ports in a way that they just aren't with other devices, means that we do never quite get there, but I think we will. I think my positive takeaway is that I do think we will, whether it's this year or early next year, especially with new form factors coming out and new Macs entering. It'll be the busiest Mac lineup in about, what, 20 years. But I think that it should be the most sort of appropriately scaled and priced. And your issue will be choosing between devices that are a little bit too similar, rather than not having having something to, you know, hit every spot.
All right, so that would have been a good transition, but I feel like we didn't talk a whole lot about the M2 Pro and M2 Max, which for the MacBook Pros, which, I mean, do you have anything of, I don't know, anything that you've found recently that you haven't stated in any of your videos that might be like a huge moment, or is it kind of status quo? It's a good upgrade. Don't upgrade from your M1 Pro, M1 Max kind of deal.
Yeah, I mean, definitely don't upgrade from a solid M1. It's, you know, I don't even know if there's many people out there considering it.
I don't think so, but
yeah, you know, it was pretty tough to discover the differences, and I did. So fortunately, in my review, because this is the challenge: is you're going into a review, you're like, oh, please don't just be exactly what everybody's expecting, because, like, it's kind of stale otherwise. If it's like, oh yeah, if you saw the keynote, that's what the computer is. The one surprise that I had, which is in my review, is just seeing Final Cut playback with a huge stack of different effects being applied, that I could play back footage on the M2 that couldn't be played back on the M1, and those are both Mac processors spec'd very similarly. So, you know, that was really nice, but I mean, there weren't a ton of surprises. One I was hoping for is that DaVinci Resolve has quite a few things. Like, it's really well optimized, much better than Premiere, but does have bottlenecks, like things that are just so intensive that it slows down any machine currently. And one is noise removal. So that's my go-to right away. Just run basic noise removal. Can it play it back? And it still couldn't. So That was the like, okay, well, I can see it got this much better, but we're still missing those really big challenges for it. So unfortunately, no, there was no big surprises, just a nice spec bump.
Yeah,
like the olden days, it's a bump and a good one, but nothing dramatic.
And not to go to bat for Apple, but like, how much of that is just kind of DaVinci's fault too, in terms of the optimization for the, you know, I'm sure it's going to do that on the best Mac or the best PC that you're running too, in terms of specs. It's probably still going to tear that apart. It's just kind of the deal with that specific test there. So, and I'm sure Apple's not just creating a computer specifically for that reason, but,
no, but it is, I do have to keep moving the benchmarks, the test, because the way I like to try to do mostly real world tests. And when you do anything synthetic or anything that gives you a number, it's a lot easier to find the difference, because you're like, okay, here's the two numbers, here's the percentage of difference between them. But in real world tests, sometimes it's so much more like, does it feel different? And now that all the basics are taken care of, it's like, I got to do the more extreme things to push it further. And it's funny. It's like, it starts making me wonder, like, as we have this headroom, which happens occasionally, right, where a computer can do a little bit more than standard common workflows, we fill it, right? So we used to edit 1080 video, and then now we edit 4K. I don't know what's going to fill that space next. That's why I was talking about AI a second ago, is there's, I think, going to be an explosion of tools. The thing is, most of them don't seem to run locally right now. There's only a few useful ones. I think one of the most interesting is Topaz Labs, which will, you know, process photos and videos. Especially the video stuff is pretty intensive. But like, how will we fill this extra space? What are we going to do with the abilities of, you know, the M2 Max and stuff? Because I don't know what to do with it right now. I just got these processors just sitting around not working half the time. So
yeah, I'm going to be honest. I am working on a M2 Max MacBook Pro video right now, and I don't know what to do with it. I don't want to do a benchmark. Yeah. I don't want
to
do.
Have, but...
Yeah, it's. I just don't know what to do with it. Like I have an idea, and I might just do it this way. I don't want to spoil it for anyone, if anyone cares. But yeah, I mean, unless you have like a maxed out version, and you're going against, you know, something else like the studio, maybe that might make for an interesting comparison, maybe. But like, I think people just kind of want us to be like, hey, what, how's the laptop from a normal everyday? It's good. Like, I don't know what to tell. It's good. Like, it's fine. It's great. I don't know how else to make that interesting.
It's really good.
It's really good. Yeah. Like, I don't know how else to make that interesting without boring benchmarks. And benchmarks are helpful, but it just, that becomes the point of the videos, because like, we don't know what else to do with it to show you.
Right. Well, or just complaining. I mean, that's another way to like, okay, how do I make the video interesting? Like, okay, I'll just find a bunch of problems. And I do think we end up nitpicking, or, I mean, I have to do this sometimes. I'm like, the overall review, especially of these new ones, it is just so overwhelmingly positive. Like, the objective thing to say about these new computers is that we're in the best place we've ever been for personal computers. Like, whichever one you buy, it's never been this good. There's never been so few compromises. But I can't just say that over and over and like retain any credibility, I feel like. So I have to like discover something that is a challenge with it. And those things are just such small details. Not much is really getting in the way of important workflows. One that keeps coming up, so I'll bring it up anytime I have a chance. AirDrop is still so flaky, and I rely on it so hard. Like, AirDrop is critical to like every workflow, especially on every set that I've been on. Most people have an iPhone, and we're throwing around files back and forth. Like, it's a big part of just showing other people stuff, or like, you know, passing around behind the scenes shots or whatever, or you know, even more commercial stuff is happening on iPhones and you send the files. AirDrop is still not reliable. I think I'd say about, you know, worked maybe 70% of the time, sometimes 60% of the time. And then there's no explanation of why it just totally flakes out. So that's not even a hardware issue, but that's the stuff that it comes down to for me, is like these details. That's what's getting in my way now.
What's the deal with AirDrop? Like, does it not connect, or is it failing midway, or is it?
Is it not you guys? I mean, well, all of the above. Most of all that it doesn't connect. And I will say, like, I think the time I tweeted about this right before a keynote was the most engagement I've had on anything I've ever tweeted. I was like, I hope they announce that they fixed AirDrop. And it was like everyone went crazy for it. So I think it's not just me, but
Hartley, do you have any major issues? Won't connect.
Well, I don't use AirDrop a whole lot, but I do recognize these issues when I do. You know, maybe 2 out of 5 times I have some sort of issue with it. So I think that's quite a lot. But I imagine if you're using AirDrop, you know, 10 times a day, then that is really going to start to get you down.
So what's funny is I don't know I don't know. Like, I know when things are an issue, but like, I don't know. If they don't inconvenience me enough to make it like a focal point of my memory, that I just, the only issue that I've noticed that really bothers me, and I think it's been fixed because I haven't noticed it recently, but I used to do this a lot where I would go to AirDrop something and it would, I don't remember which way it was done. I think it's through Finder. If I like right clicked and shared that way, it would get stuck. And I'd have to basically force quit Finder in order to send anything. Like if I tapped on anyone, nothing would happen. And it would basically get stuck and that AirDrop window wouldn't go away. And I couldn't get rid of it no matter what I did. I'd have to force quit the whole thing and relaunch that. And then, yeah, every once in a while, I'll click on somebody. Go ahead.
I'll point out why it came to mind as well. So a specific bug that has happened on multiple machines that are like not even connected to it, no relation between these machines. And it's happening to me right now that I canceled an AirDrop yesterday and it just keeps reactivating and popping up. So while I'm talking to you guys, I have the AirDrop notification going off in my ear for something that it's not being resent. The computers are...
See, I've never come across that.
It's closed. It's coming from a MacBook Pro that is not on. And that's it funny. Just keeps popping up.
That's annoying.
So things like that just drives me really crazy. Yeah.
Maybe someone's just randomly trying to send you something. You have like a bunch of people nearby.
Well, they have my avatar. So trolling me.
Bots are crazy these days. All right. So the last thing I do want to bring up then, because we've spent a majority of this episode on Macs, rightfully so. But I do want to briefly touch on, and I know you said you're not a big rumors guy, so we'll fill you in a little bit and stop me if you are aware. Well, actually, Hartley's really good at this. I also try to stay away from rumors as much as possible. And I'm just kind of in my silo of making videos about what's happening right now. But we are expecting some big camera improvements to the iPhone 15. And that's Hartley helped me here, the Periscope lens, and then just new lenses in general.
And then new Sony sensors.
There's new Sony sensors. So yeah,
those will be the two main upgrades that we're looking at.
So what are you hoping from a photographer standpoint? Like what's on your wish list for the next iPhone?
I mean, I don't think the sensors are holding us back right now. I'm sure a lot of people have seen Marquez's recent video talking about the issues with iPhone photography. And I think he's describing it accurately. What I find to be the biggest problem with the iPhone 14 Pro anyway, is that when I shoot in RAW, the photos look amazing. And the problem right now isn't that we need more detail. It's that we need less sort of synthetic detail. It's being heavily sharpened, like just so much. I had to edit we were traveling for a while in Asia, and I was putting together a blog post for my wife of iPhone photos mixed in with large sensor photos as well. So we had three different cameras and trying to get them all to match. And the thing that makes the iPhone photos jump out is they just look crazy over sharpened. Like, I mean, beyond, like so far beyond the bigger sensors. And when I've done tests shooting raw and comparing it side by side, you can get them to just match. Like it's incredible actually how close they can look, and that it really responds in the same way to the full frame mirrorless. I mean, obviously not the same level of detail and stuff, level of dynamic range, there's more noise, but in good situations, you can effectively have them match. When you shoot directly out of the iPhone right now, that is not happening. And I think most people don't notice, because on a phone screen, on a smaller screen, it does look great. And that's what it's really optimized for. That's the type of sharpening. Like when you sharpen an image, there's different ways to do it. Some are optimized for print, some are optimized for small viewing. You would sharpen it differently for a thumbnail. Depends how the size that you're going to see it at. And once you blow up a phone photo on any monitor, it is over sharpened for that viewing size. So I think we need to find a way to basically just scrape away that extra kind of sludgy processing look and get to what is actually being provided by the sensors. And especially for video, because in photo, we can at least shoot raw and we can process that away, but there's no way around it with video, you know, even shooting ProRes, whatever you do, the giveaway that it's iPhone footage is it's too sharp in a fake way. So that's the biggest thing that I'd hope for. That Periscope lens would be nice. I mean, I reviewed the Pixel 7 this year. I hadn't reviewed a Pixel for a little while, but that zoom lens is so really good. Solid on it. Yeah, it's excellent. That would be nice, but it's not the most important to me. Getting that 1X, that main lens, just really dialed in, that's the most important thing.
I used to commend like Apple for, you know, being a more neutral shot, and like it wasn't oversaturated. Like you'd get Samsung phones and they might be a little too much in the saturate. And then I've done the whole live photo thing where you like tap on the live photo and you notice that it looks totally different. And then when you let go, it's like all the stuff that they've done in the background just came in. You're like, wait, what? That doesn't look anything like what the actual little video portion was. What happened? I don't know how many of you guys have run into that, but.
There also seems to be a bit of I don't know if I can call it a bug, but a weirdness I can't track down when it happens. I notice it on the iPhone Pro Max and not the iPhone Pro, that it will have a really aggressive snap into like an over HDR look after taking the photo that, you know, it seems like it's the same way that Deep Fusion has always been. When you take a Deep Fusion shot, you'll see it snap a second or two afterwards. But it's like it's aggressive. It's like the exposure changes. It makes the whole image brighter. And I didn't find that on the 13, and it doesn't happen all the time. So I haven't included it in any videos because like I don't know how to recreate it often enough. Mm-hmm. And I also don't really know what it is. I don't know what's happening. So there's a little bit of weirdness going on in there. But that all ties into the sort of over-processing story. I just want them to sort of simplify the look of the image, like make it look a little more raw or neutral.
So do you think that that's a result of year upon year upon year of iterating on the way that iPhone photos are processed? Or is it an intentional vision of how iPhone photos should look for optimized for a small screen? Because I wonder if it's more that the hardware has got away from the software, and that, you know, when we were looking at 12 megapixel lenses, go back to sensors, I don't know when it was the first 12 megapixel, like with the iPhone 6S, and that's when there were the first live photos, and that was one of the jumps in the iPhone's photography capabilities years ago. And of course, all of these things have been layered up year after year, you know, Deep Fusion 1 year, adding more iPhone lenses. And I wonder if it's just the compounding effect of that, and how Apple can really row that back. Or I don't know. I mean, maybe these things are really heavily differ from device to device. I mean, there's certainly different versions of Smart HDR, for example. So what are your thoughts about that, Tyler?
Yeah. I do think it's just the hardware and software kind of getting out of sync, which it's going to be challenging for them going forward too, when there's a different sensor on the Pro versus the iPhone 14. I always loved that when I previously could review the regular iPhone and the Pro, that I could say like, look, these are the same cameras, like almost, right? Except for you're missing or gaining some lenses, but they're effectively the same. And I would actually do my iPhone camera reviews as one chunk. Like I wouldn't separate the Pro review from the regular one. And now it's really hard. Like I don't love the idea where people with an iPhone Pro are going to have just images that look completely different from people that have a regular iPhone. That doesn't seem like the ideal world to me, but it also seems sort of necessary to fix those Pro images right now. So I don't know, maybe they can strike a balance of finding the software optimization that looks great on both kinds of sensors, or there's, you know, a sensor that scales better between the two of them. But I don't know. It's a bit of speculation on like where the fix for this problem is. I know anytime I've talked to people from Apple that work in the photo world, like they share my taste of like what the priority should be and what a good image is. So I do trust that they are targeting the right things, and I'm sure they're just as aware of what they're not achieving. I think a common example of that is we've always got those crazy halos in night photos that have been like the ghosting has been for a while now, and because I hear about the comments a lot, like I'll mention it in the reviews, and then the comments are like, yeah, but these, like, I can't believe they haven't fixed that. There's nobody more aware of these ghosting issues than Apple. Like, they know, and I'm sure it drives their engineers crazy, because like, they're great photographers. Like, they love a good camera and they see these issues, but it doesn't mean that there's an easy solution. So I don't know. I'm sure they see these same processing issues that I'm talking about. And I hope they have some answers lined up.
So looking at that telephoto camera specifically that we're expecting to get later this year, what would you want to see from that? What level of optical zoom would be preferable, and how we're expecting this to specifically be on the highest end models, so the Pro Max, or if the name changes to Ultra, and that will be Apple's first periscope camera. So what will that camera need to do to keep you happy, basically?
I just think they really have to prioritize quality. There's been this with a lot of the Android phones, this feeling of like, well, the quality on the zoom is mediocre. You lose a lot of dynamic range. There's a lot more noise, but look how far you can see. And then all it's really good for is sort of proving that something happened, right? Because there's a difference between photography that looks aesthetically pleasing, like nice photography, and just documenting, just showing like this was here, I was here. Yeah. And those longer zoom lenses, a lot of the time, that's kind of all they're really good for. The Pixel 7 did improve that a bit, actually. I think we're kind of there, but that's what I want them to prioritize. I actually don't care about how far it is. I don't need it to be five times. On my regular photo cameras, like 100 millimeters is pretty far. Like, I don't need 200 millimeter or 300 millimeter equivalents on my phone. I'm really comfortable with it just being, extend that reach a little bit, getting to maybe 4x. Would be fine as long as it continues to kind of match the other cameras, so that as you zoom in and out, you don't see a big jump in quality. That's just what I want them to focus on most. And I'm not an engineer of any kind, so I don't know where that balance is going to be. I hope that's something they think about. And just something to the last question before it slips my mind, I really want them to also think a little bit more about exposure stability and white balance. As a professional, so I've been shooting a lot more jobs on my phone. Huge problem is that the Apple camera app is the best camera app, especially for video. Unfortunately, others, so like Filmic Pro, I go to when I can, but it doesn't use the same stabilization. So you get a visible delay in a lot of the stabilization methods. And the exposure also isn't as flexible. Like when you tap on screen, it doesn't do the same dynamic range adjustments as the default camera app. You can end up with clipped highlights in Filmic or Moment or any third-party app that you don't get in Apple's camera app. And because of that, it's like, well, I got to use the camera app. But I can't lock exposure or white balance separately. So if I'm just like walking around filming anything, I'll just see them like going up and down. Like skies will be like, not flickering, but there's a little bit of like dancing of it's like, oh, a cloud came in, so the phone tries to lift and drop it. Or especially white balance is much worse, where as you look around a room and there's like, say, a wooden wall or something that's very skin colored, it'll like shift to being very blue for a moment, and then it'll come back to yellow. All of this just looks terrible. Like it looks really bad. And at the very least, what I'd hope for from a professional mode is like, look, just make it all more stable. Don't change throughout the shot so much, even if I can't override it manually. So that's actually just a software thing. It's not very advanced, really. It's more about some design decisions, but it would make a huge difference for professionals.
I agree with everything. I don't really know that I have any huge wish list. I agree with you on the saturation and the sharpening thing. We need to take it a step back. But just a little bit. But is there anything else that you wanted to add before we wrap up on either the Max or the iPhone photography that we just talked about?
I could ramble on forever. So it depends if you prompt me or not, then I'll go on. But it sounds like I'm going to lose my voice first. But
well, yeah, we try to keep things at about an hour anyway. So all right. Well, this is your time. I think plenty of people have seen your work, but I highly recommend everyone to go check out the latest videos here on the new Max. They were great. I did watch. I mean, we ask you about it, but like I watched them, so I wanted you to know that they were great. The whole running through the timeline, it was crazy to see.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, of course. It was crazy to see the difference in the Max chip there, just being able to shred through it, while the M1 Max was like, was not able to get. So definitely people go check it out. But is there anywhere else or anything else that you'd like to plug? Now is your time.
Yeah. If people listen to podcasts, the Stallman podcast is mine. And I just had the VP of hardware engineering on to talk about Apple's process designing these new M2 processors. So, you know, it's nice getting those little behind the scenes chats. And then I also have other YouTubers and people in the Apple world and creator world. That's usually what I'm talking about, is like cameras and Apple. Those are the big things. So yeah, the podcast is a good one.
Definitely go check it out. Thanks, Tyler. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.